and watched the fickle winds play across the forbidding world outside. Her hands worked the yarn into rows, requiring only occasional glances to keep her place. Often the dust flew toward the silo's sensors and sheets, each wave causing her to cringe as if a physical blow were about to land. This assault of blurring grime was difficult to watch at any time, but especially brutal the day after a cleaning. Each touch of dust on the clouding lenses was a violation, a dirty man touching something pure. Johns remembered what that felt like. And 60 years later, she sometimes wondered if the misting of grime on those lenses, if the bodily sacrifice needed to keep them clean, wasn't even more painful for her to abide.
Ma'am?
Mayor Johns turned away from the sight of the dead hills cradling her recently deceased sheriff. She turned to find Deputy Marnes standing by her side.
Yes, Marnes.
You asked for these? Marnes placed 3 manila folders on the cafeteria table and slid them toward her through the scattered crumbs and juice stains of last night's cleaning celebration. John set her knitting aside and reluctantly reached for the folders. What she really wanted was to be left alone a little longer, to watch rows of knots become something. She wanted to enjoy the peace and quiet of this unspoiled sunrise, before the grime and the years dulled it, before the rest of the upper silo awoke, rubbed the sleep from their eyes and the stains from their consciences, and came up to crowd around her in their own plastic chairs and take it all in. But duty beckoned. She was mayor by choice, and the silo needed a sheriff. So Johns put aside her own wants and desires and weighed the folders in her lap. Caressing the cover of the first one, she looked down at her hands with something between pain and acceptance. The backs of them appeared as dry and crinkled as the pulp paper hanging out of the folders. She glanced over at Deputy Marnes, whose white mustache was flecked with the occasional black. She remembered when the colors were the other way around, when his tall, thin frame was a mark of vigor and youth rather than gaunt fragility. He was handsome still, but only because she knew him from long ago, only because her old eyes still remembered.
You know, she told Marnes, we could do this different this time. You could let me promote you to sheriff, hire yourself a deputy, and do this proper.
Marnes laughed.
I've been deputy almost as long as you've been mayor, ma'am. Don't figure on being nothing else but dead one day.
Johns nodded. One of the things she loved about having Marnes around was that his thoughts could be so black as to make hers shine gray.
I fear that day is rapidly approaching for us both, she said.
Truer than true, I reckon. Never figured to outlive so many. Sure as sin don't see me outliving you.
Marnes rubbed his mustache and studied the view of the outside. Johns smiled at him, opened the folder on top, and studied the first bio.
That's 3 decent candidates, Marnes said. Just like you asked for. Be happy to work with any of them. Juliet, I think she's in the middle there, would be my first pick. Works down in mechanical. Don't come up much, but me and Holston...
Marnes paused and cleared his throat. Johns glanced over and saw that her deputy's gaze had crept toward that dark crook in the hill. He covered his mouth with a fist of sharp knuckles and faked a cough.
Excuse me, he said. As I was saying, the sheriff and me worked to death down there a few years back. This Juliet, I think she prefers jewels, come to think of it, was a right shiner. Sharp as a tack. Big help on this case. Good at spotting details, handling people, being diplomatic but firm, all that. I don't think she comes up past the 80s much. A down deeper, for sure, which we ain't had in a while.
Johns sorted through Juliet's folder, checking her family tree, her voucher history, her current pay and chits. She was listed as a shift foreman with good marks. No history in the lottery.
Never married?
Johns asked.
Nope. Something of a John boy. A wrencher, you know. We were down there a week, saw how the guys took to her. Now she could have her pick of them boys, but chooses not to. Kind of person who leaves an impression but prefers to go it alone.
Sure seems like she left an impression on you,
Johns said, regretting it immediately. She hated the jealous tone in her own voice. Marnes shifted his weight to his other foot.
Well, you know me, Mayor. I'm always sizing up candidates. Anything to keep from being promoted.
John smiled.
What about the other two?
She checked the names, wondering if a down deeper was a good idea, or possibly worried about Marnes's having a crush. She recognized the name on the top folder Peter Billings. He worked a few floors down in judicial, as a clerk or a judge's shadow.
Honestly, ma'am, they're filler to make it seem fair. Like I said, I'd work with them, but I think Jules is your girl. Been a long time since we had a lass for sheriff. Be a popular choice with an election coming up.
That won't be why we choose, John said. Whoever we decide on will probably be here long after we're gone. She stopped herself as she recalled having said the same thing about Holston, back when he'd been chosen. Johns closed the folder and returned her attention to the wall screen. A small tornado had formed at the base of the hill. The gathering dust whipped into an organized frenzy. It built some steam, this small wisp, as it swelled into a larger cone, spinning and spinning on a wavering tip like a child's top, as it raced toward sensors that fairly sparkled in the wan rays of a clear sunrise.
I think we should go see her, Johns finally said.
She kept the folders in her lap, fingers like rolled parchment toying with the rough edges of handmade paper.
Ma'am, I'd rather us fetch her up here, do the interview in your office, like we've always done. It's a long way down to her, and an even longer way back up.
I appreciate the concern, Deputy, I do, but it's been a long while since I've been much past the 40th. My knees are no excuse not to see my people.
The mayor stopped. The tornado of dust wavered, turned, and headed straight for them. It grew and grew, the wide angle of the lens distorting it into a monster much larger and more fierce than she knew it to actually be. And then it blew over the sensor array, the entire cafeteria descending into a brief darkness until the Zephyr caromed past, retreating across the screen in the lounge and leaving behind it a view of the world now tainted with a slight dingy film.
Damn those things, Deputy Marnes said through gritted teeth.
The aged leather of his holster squeaked as he rested his hand on the butt of his gun, and Johns imagined the old deputy out on that landscape, chasing the wind on thin legs or pumping bullets into a cloud of fading dust. The two of them sat silent a moment, surveying the damage. Finally, John spoke.
This trip won't be about the election, Marnes. It won't be for votes, either. For all I know, I'll run again unopposed. So we won't make a deal of it, and we'll travel light and quiet. I want to see my people, not be seen by them.
She looked over at him, found that he was watching her.
It'll be for me, Marnes. A getaway.
She turned back to the view.
Sometimes I just think I've been up here too long. The both of us. I think we've been anywhere too long.
The ringing of morning footsteps in the spiral staircase gave her pause, and they both turned toward the sound of life, the sound of a waking day. And she knew it was time to start getting the images of dead things out of her mind, or at least to bury them for a while.
We'll go down and get us a proper gauge of this Juliet, you and me. Because sometimes, sitting here, looking out on what the world makes us do, it needles me deep, Marnes. It needles me straight through.
They met after breakfast in Holston's old office. Johns still thought of it as his a day later. It was too early for her to think of the room as anything else. She stood beyond the twin desks and old filing cabinets and peered into the empty holding cell, while Deputy Marnes gave last-minute instructions to Terry, a burly security worker from IT who often held down the fort while Marnes and Holston were away on a case. Standing dutifully behind Terry was a teenager named Marcia, a young girl with dark hair and bright eyes who was apprenticing for work in IT. She was Terry's shadow. Just about half of the workers in the silo had one. They ranged in age from 12 to 20, these ever-present sponges absorbing the lessons and techniques for keeping the silo operational for at least one generation more. Deputy Marnes reminded Terry how rowdy people got after a cleaning. Once the tension was released, people tended to live it up a little. They thought, for a few months at least, that anything went. The warning hardly needed saying. The revelry in the next room could be heard through the shut door. Most residents from the top 40 were already packed into the cafeteria and lounge. Hundreds more from the mids and the down deep would trickle up throughout the day, asking for time off work and turning in holiday chits, just to see the mostly clear view of the world outside. It was a pilgrimage for many. Some came up only once every few years, stood around for an hour, muttering that it looked the same as they remembered, then shooed their children down the stairs ahead of them, fighting the upward surging crowds. Terry was left with the keys and a temporary badge. Marnes checked the batteries in his wireless, made sure the volume on the office unit was up, and inspected his gun. He shook Terry's hand and wished him luck. Johns sensed it was almost time for them to go and turned away from the empty cell. She said goodbye to Terry, gave Marcia a nod, and followed Marnes out the door.
"You feel okay leaving right after a cleaning?"
she asked as they stepped out into the cafeteria. She knew how rowdy it would get later that night and how testy the crowd would become. It seemed an awful time to drag him away on a mostly selfish errand.
"Are you kidding? I need this. I need to get away."
He glanced toward the wall screen, which was obscured by the crowds.
"I still can't figure what Holston was thinking. Can't reckon why he never talked to me about all that was going on in that head of his. Maybe by the time we get back, I won't feel him in the office anymore, 'cause right now I can't hardly breathe in there."
Johns thought about this as they fought through the crowded cafeteria. Plastic cups sloshed with a mix of fruit juices, and she smelled the sting of tub-brewed alcohol in the air, but ignored it. People were wishing her well, asking her to be careful, promising to vote. News of their trip had leaked out faster than the spiked punch, despite their hardly telling anyone. Most were under the impression that it was a goodwill trip, a re-election campaign. The younger silo residents, who only remembered Holston as sheriff, were already saluting Marnes and giving him that honorific title. Anyone with wrinkles around their eyes knew better. They nodded to the duo as they passed through the cafeteria and wished them a different sort of unspoken luck.
"Keep us going," their eyes said. "Make it so my kids live as long as me. Don't let it unravel. Not just yet."
Johns lived under the weight of this pressure, a burden brutal on more than knees. She kept quiet as they made their way to the central stairwell. A handful called for her to make a speech, but the lone voices did not gain traction. No chant formed, much to her relief. What would she say? That she didn't know why it all held together? That she didn't even understand her own knitting? How if you made knots, and if you did it right, things just worked out? Would she tell them it took only one snip for it all to unravel? One cut, and you could pull and pull and turn that garment into a pile? Did they really expect her to understand, when all she did was follow the rules, and somehow it kept working out, year after year after year? Because she didn't understand what held it together. And she didn't understand their mood, this celebration. Were they drinking and shouting because they were safe? Because they'd been spared by fate, passed over for cleaning? Her people cheered while a good man, her friend, her partner in keeping them alive and well, lay dead on a hill next to his wife. If she gave a speech, if it weren't full of the forbidden, it would be this: that no two better people had ever gone to cleaning of their own free will. And what did that say about the lot of them who remained? Now was not the time for speeches, or for drinking, or for being merry. Now was the hour of quiet contemplation, which was one of the reasons Johns knew she needed to get away. Things had changed, not just by the day, but by the long years. She knew better than most. Maybe old Lady McLean, down in supply, knew, could see it coming. One had to live a long time to be sure. But now she was, and as time marched on, carrying her world faster than her feet could catch up, Mayor Johns knew that it would soon leave her completely behind. And her great fear, unspoken but daily felt, was that this world of theirs probably wouldn't stagger very far along without her. 9. Johns's walking stick made a conspicuous ring as it impacted each metal step. It soon became a metronome for their descent, timing the music of the stairwell, which was crowded and vibrating with the energy of a recent cleaning. All the traffic seemed to be heading upward, save for the two of them. They jostled against the flow, elbows brushing, cries of, "Hey, Mayor!" followed by nods to Marnes. And Johns saw it on their faces, the temptation to call him Sheriff, tempered by their respect for the awful nature of his assumed promotion.
"How many floors you up for?" Marnes asked. "Why, are you tired already?"
Johns glanced over her shoulder to smirk at him, saw his bushy mustache twisted up in a smile of his own.
"Going down ain't a problem for me. It's the going back up I can't stand."
Their hands briefly collided on the twisted railing of the spiral staircase, Johns's hand trailing behind her, Marnes's reaching ahead. She felt like telling him she wasn't tired at all. But she did feel a sudden weariness, an exhaustion more mental than physical. She had a childish vision of more youthful times and pictured Marnes scooping her up and carrying her down the staircase in his arms. There would be a sweet release of strength and responsibility, a sinking into another's power, no need to feign her own. This was not a remembrance of the past. It was a future that had never happened. And Johns felt guilty for even thinking it. She felt her husband beside her, his ghost perturbed by her thoughts.
Mayor? How many are you thinking?
The two of them stopped and hugged the rail as a porter trudged up the stairs. Johns recognized the boy, Connor, still in his teens, but already with a strong back and steady stride. He had an array of bundles strapped together and balanced on his shoulders. The sneer on his face was not from exhaustion or pain, but annoyance. Who were all these people suddenly on his stairwell? These tourists? Johns thought of something encouraging to say. Some small verbal reward for these people who did a job her knees never could. But he was already gone on his strong young feet, carrying food and supplies up from the down deep, slowed only by the crush of traffic attempting to worm up through the silo for a peek of the clear and wide outside. She and Marnes caught their breath for a moment between flights. Marnes handed her his canteen, and she took a polite sip before passing it back.
"I'd like to do half today," she finally answered, "but I want to make a few stops on the way."
Marnes took a swig of water and began twisting the cap back on.
"House calls?"
"Something like that. I want to stop at the nursery on 20.
Marnes laughed.
"Kissing babies? Mayor, ain't nobody gonna vote you out, not at your age."
Johns didn't laugh.
"Thanks,"
she said with a mask of false pain.
"But no, not to kiss babies."
She turned her back and resumed walking. Marnes followed.
"It's not that I don't trust your professional opinion about this Jules lady. You haven't picked anything but a winner since I've been mayor."
"Even..."
Marnes interrupted.
"Especially him,"
John said, knowing what he was thinking.
"He was a good man, but he had a broken heart. That'll take even the best of them down."
Marnes grunted his agreement.
"So what are we checking at the nursery? This Juliet weren't born on the 20th, not if I recall."
"No, but her father works there now. I thought, since we were passing by, that we'd get a feel for the man, get some insight on his daughter."
"A father for a character witness?"
Marnes laughed.
"Don't reckon you'll get much of an impartial there."
"I think you'll be surprised,"
John said.
"I had Alice do some digging while I was packing. She found something interesting."
"Yeah?"
"This Juliet character still has every vacation chit she's ever earned."
"That ain't rare for mechanical,"
Marnes said.
"They do a lot of overtime."
"Not only does she not get out, she doesn't have visitors."
"I still don't see where you're going with this."
Johns waited while a family passed. A young boy, 6 or 7 probably, rode on his father's shoulders with his head ducked to avoid the undersides of the stairs above. The mother brought up the rear, an overnight bag draped over her shoulder, a swaddled infant cradled in her arms. It was the perfect family, Johns thought. Replacing what they took, 2 for 2. Just what the lottery aimed for, and sometimes provided.
"Well then, let me tell you where I'm going with this,"
she told Marnes.
"I want to find this girl's father, look him in the eyes, and ask him why, in the nearly 20 years since his daughter moved to mechanical, he hasn't visited her. Not once."
She looked back at Marnes, saw him frowning at her beneath his mustache.
"And why she hasn't once made her way up to see him," she added.
The traffic thinned as they made their way into the teens and past the upper apartments. With each step down, Johns dreaded having to reclaim those lost inches on the way back up. This was the easy part, she reminded herself. The descent was like the uncoiling of a steel spring, pushing her down. It reminded Johns of nightmares she'd had of drowning. Silly nightmares, considering she'd never seen enough water to submerge herself in, much less enough that she couldn't stand up to breathe. But they were like the occasional dreams of falling from great heights, some legacy of another time, broken fragments unearthed in each of their sleeping minds that suggested, we weren't supposed to live like this. And so the descent, this spiraling downward, was much like the drowning that swallowed her at night. It felt inexorable and inextricable, like a weight pulling her down, combined with the knowledge that she'd never be able to claw her way back up. They passed the garment district next, the land of multicolored coveralls, and the place her balls of yarn came from. The smell of the dyes and other chemicals drifted over the landing. A window cut into the curving cinder blocks looked through to a small food shop at the edge of the district. It had been ransacked by the crowds, shelves emptied by the crushing demand of exhausted hikers and the extra post-cleaning traffic. Several porters crowded up the stairs with heavy loads, trying their best to satisfy demand, and Johns recognized an awful truth about yesterday's cleaning. The barbaric practice brought more than psychological relief. More than just a clear view of the outside, it also buttressed the silo's economy. There was suddenly an excuse to travel, an excuse to trade, and as gossip flowed and family and old friends met again for the first time in months or perhaps years, there was a vitality injected into the entire silo. It was like an old body stretching and loosening its joints, blood flowing to the extremities. A decrepit thing was becoming alive again.
Mayor!
She turned to find Marnes almost out of sight around the spiral above her. She paused while he caught up, watching his feet as he hurried.
Easy, he said. I can't keep up if you take off like that.
Johns apologized. She hadn't been aware of any change in her pace. As they entered the second tier of apartments, down below the 16th floor, Johns realized she was already in territory she hadn't seen in almost a year. There was the rattle here of younger legs chasing along the stairwell, getting tangled up in the slow climbers. The grade school for the upper third was just above the nursery. From the sound of all the traffic and voices, school had been canceled. Johns imagined it was a combination of knowing how few would turn up for class, with parents taking their kids up to the view, plus how many teachers would want to do the same. They passed the landing for the school, where chalk games of hop and square four were blurred from the day's traffic, where kids sat hugging the rails, skinned knees poking out, feet swinging below the jutting landings, and where catcalls and eager shouts faded to secret whispers in the presence of adults.
Glad we're almost there. I need a rest, Marnes said,
as they spiraled down one more flight to the nursery.
I just hope this feller's available to see us.
He will be, John said. Alice wired him from my office that we were coming.
They crossed traffic at the nursery landing and caught their breath. When Marnes passed his canteen, Johns took a long pull and then checked her hair in its curved and dented surface.
You look fine, he said.
Mayoral?
He laughed.
And then some.
Johns thought she saw a twinkle in his old brown eyes when he said this, but it was probably the light bouncing off the canteen as he brought it to his lips.
20 floors in just over 2 hours. Don't recommend the pace, but I'm glad we're this far already.
He wiped his mustache and reached around to try to slip the canteen back into his pack.
Here,
John said. She took the canteen from him and slid it into the webbed pouch on the rear of his pack.
And let me do the talking in here, she reminded him.
Marnes lifted his hands and showed his palms, as if no other thought had ever crossed his mind. He stepped past her and pulled one of the heavy metal doors open, the customary squeal of rusted hinges not coming as expected. The silence startled Johns. She was used to hearing the chirp of old doors up and down the staircase as they opened and closed. They were the stairwell's version of the wildlife found in the farms, ever present and always singing. But these hinges were coated in oil, rigorously maintained. The signs on the walls of the waiting room reinforced the observation. They demanded silence and bold letters, accompanied by pictures of fingers over lips and circles with slashes through open mouths. The nursery evidently took its quietude seriously.
Don't remember so many signs last time I was here, Marnes whispered.
Maybe you were too busy yapping to notice,
Johns replied. A nurse glared at them through a glass window, and Johns elbowed Marnes.
Mayor Johns to see Peter Nichols, she told the woman.
The nurse behind the window didn't blink.
I know who you are. I voted for you.
Oh, of course. Well, thank you.
If you'll come around.
The woman hit a button on her desk, and the door beside her buzzed faintly. Marnes pushed on the door, and Johns followed him through.
If you'll don these.
The nurse, Margaret, according to the hand-drawn tag on her collar, held out two neatly folded white cloth robes. Johns accepted them both and handed one to Marnes.
You can leave your bags with me.
There was no refusing Margaret. Johns felt at once that she was in this much younger woman's world, that she had become her inferior when she passed through that softly buzzing door. She leaned her walking stick against the wall, took her pack off, and lowered it to the ground, then shrugged on the robe. Marne struggled with his until Margaret helped, holding the sleeve in place. He wrestled the robe over his denim shirt and held the loose ends of the long fabric waist tie as if its working was beyond his abilities. He watched John's, not hers, and finally made enough of a mess of it for the robe to hold fairly together.
"What?" he asked, noticing the way John's was watching him. "This is what I've got cuffs for, so I never learned to tie a knot. So what?"
"In 60 years, John said.
Margaret pressed another button on her desk and pointed down the hall. "Dr. Nichols is in the nursery. I'll let him know you're coming." John's led the way. Marnes followed, asking her,
"Why is that so hard to believe?"
"I think it's cute, actually."
Marnes snorted.
"That's an awful word to use on a man my age."
John smiled to herself. At the end of the hall, she paused before a set of double doors before pushing them open a crack. The light in the room beyond was dim. She opened the door further, and they entered a sparse but clean waiting room. She remembered a similar one from the mid-levels, where she had waited with a friend to be reunited with her child. A glass wall looked into a room that held a handful of cribs and bassinets. John's hand dropped to her hip. She rubbed the hard nub of her now useless implant, inserted at birth and never removed, not once. Being in that nursery reminded her of all she had lost, all she had given up for her work, for her ghosts. It was too dark inside the nursery to see if any of the small beds stirred with newborns. She was notified of every birth, of course. As mayor, she signed a letter of congratulations and a birth certificate for each one, but the names ran together with the days. She could rarely remember what level the parents lived on, if it was their first or second. It made her sad to admit it. But those certificates had become just more paperwork, another rote duty. The shadowy outline of an adult moved among the small cribs, the shiny clamp of a clipboard and the flash of a metal pen winking in the light of the observation room. The dark shape was obviously tall, with the gait and build of an older man. He took his time, noting something as he hovered over a crib, the two shimmers of metal uniting to jot a note. When he was done, he crossed the room and passed through a wide door to join Marnes and Johns in the waiting room. Peter Nichols was an imposing figure, John saw. Tall and lean, but not like Marnes, who seemed to fold and unfold unsure limbs to move about. Peter was lean like a habitual exerciser, like a few porters Johns knew who could take the stairs two at a time and make it look like they'd been expressly designed for such a pace. It was height that lent confidence. Johns could feel it as she took Peter's outstretched hand and let him pump it firmly.
"You came,"
Dr. Nichols said simply. It was a cold observation. There was only a hint of surprise. He shook Marnes's hand, but his eyes returned to John's.
"I explained to your secretary that it wouldn't be much help. I'm afraid I haven't seen Juliet since she became a shadow 20 years ago.
"Well, that's actually what I wanted to talk to you about."
Johns glanced at the cushioned benches where she imagined anxious grandparents, aunts and uncles, waited while parents were united with their newborns.
"Could we sit?"
Dr. Nichols nodded and waved them over.
"I take each of my appointments for office very seriously,"
Johns explained, sitting across from the doctor.
"At my age, I expect most judges and lawmen I install to outlive me, so I choose carefully."
"But they don't always, do they?"
Dr. Nichols tilted his head, no expression on his lean and carefully shaven face.
"Outlive you, I mean."
Johns swallowed. Marnes stirred on the bench beside her.
"You must value family,"
Johns said, changing the subject, realizing this was just another observation, no harm meant.
"To have shadowed so long, and to choose such a demanding line of work?"
Nichols nodded.
"Why do you and Juliet never visit? I mean, not once in 20 years. She's your only child."
Nichols turned his head slightly, his eyes drifting to the wall. Johns was momentarily distracted by the sight of another form moving behind the glass, a nurse making the rounds. Another set of doors led off to what she assumed were the delivery rooms, where right now a convalescing new mother was probably waiting to be handed her most precious possession.
"I had a son as well,"
Dr. Nichols said. Johns felt herself reaching for her bag to procure the folders within, but it wasn't by her side. This was a detail she'd missed. A brother.
You couldn't have known, Nichols said,
correctly reading the shock on Mayor Johns's face.
He didn't survive. Technically, he wasn't born. The lottery moved on.
I'm sorry.
She fought the urge to reach over and hold Marnes's hand. It had been decades since the two of them had purposefully touched, even innocently. But the sudden sadness in the room punctured that intervening time.
His name was going to be Nicholas, my father's father's name. He was born prematurely. 1 pound 8 ounces.
The clinical precision in his voice was somehow sadder than an outpouring of emotion might have been.
They intubated, moved him into an incubator, but there were complications.
Dr. Nichols looked down at the backs of his hands.
Juliet was 13 at the time. She was as excited as we were, if you can imagine, to have a baby brother on the way. She was 1 year out from shadowing her mother, who was a delivery nurse.
Nichols glanced up.
Not here in this nursery, mind you, but in the old mid-level nursery, where we both worked. I was still an intern then.
And Juliet?
Mayor John still didn't understand the connection.
There was a failure with the incubator. But Nicholas?
The doctor turned his head to the side and brought his hand halfway to his eyes, but was able to compose himself.
I'm sorry, I still call him that.
It's okay.
Mayor Johns was holding Deputy Marnes's hand. She wasn't sure when or how that had happened. The doctor didn't seem to notice, or more likely care.
Poor Juliet.
He shook his head.
She was distraught. She blamed Rhoda at first. An experienced delivery nurse who had done nothing but work a miracle to give our boy the slim chance he had. I explained this. I think Juliet knew. She just needed someone to hate.
He nodded to Johns.
Girls that age, you know.
Believe it or not, I remember.
Johns forced a smile, and Dr. Nichols returned it. She felt Marnes squeeze her hand.
It wasn't until her mother died that she took to blaming the incubator that had failed. Well, not the incubator, but the poor condition it was in. The general state of rot all things become.
Your wife died from the complications?
It was another detail Johns felt she must have missed from the file.
My wife killed herself a week later.
Again, the clinical detachment. Johns wondered if this was a survival mechanism that had kicked in after these events, or a personality trait already in place.
Seems like I would remember that,
Deputy Marnes said, the first words he'd uttered since introducing himself to the doctor.
Well, I wrote the certificate myself, so I could put whatever cause I wanted. And you admit to this?
Marnes seemed ready to leap off the bench. To do what, Johns could hardly guess. She held his arm to keep him in place.
Beyond the statute of limitations? Of course. I admit it. It was a worthless lie, anyway. Juliet was smart, even at that age. She knew. And this is what drove her—
He stopped himself.
Drove her what?
Mayor Johns asked.
Crazy?
No.
Dr. Nichols shook his head.
I wasn't going to say that. It's what drove her away. She applied for a change in casters, demanded to move down to mechanical, to enter the shop as a shadow. She was a year too young for that sort of placement, but I agreed. I signed off on it. I thought she'd go, get some deep air, come back. I was naive. I thought the freedom would be good for her.
And you haven't seen her since?
Once, for her mother's funeral, just a few days later. She marched up on her own, attended the burial, gave me a hug, then marched back down. All without rest, from what I've heard. I try to keep up with her. I have a colleague in the deep nursery who will wire now and then with a bit of news. It's all focus, focus, focus with her.
Nichols paused and laughed.
You know, when she was young, all I saw was her mother in her. That she grew up to be more like me.
Is there anything you know that would preclude her from, or make her ill-suited for the job of silo sheriff? You do understand what's involved with the job, right?
I understand.
Nichols looked over at Marnes, his eye drifting to the copper badge visible through the open, shoddily tied robe, down to the bulge of a pistol at his side.
All the little lawmen throughout the silo have to have someone up top, giving commands, is that it?
More or less,
John said.
Why her?
Marnes cleared his throat.
She helped us with an investigation once. Jules? She was up here?
No, we were down there.
She has no training.
None of us have, Marne said. It's more of a political office, a citizen's post.
She won't agree to it.
Why not?
Johns asked. Nichols shrugged.
You'll see for yourself, I suppose.
He stood.
I wish I could give you more time, but I really should get back.
He glanced at the set of double doors.
We'll be bringing a family in soon.
I understand.
Johns rose and shook his hand.
I appreciate your seeing us.
He laughed.
Did I have a choice?
Of course.
Well, I wish I'd known that sooner.
He smiled, and John saw that he was joking, or attempting to. As they parted company and walked back down the hallway to collect their things and return the robes, John's found herself more and more intrigued by this nomination of Marnes's. It wasn't his style. A woman from the down deep. A person with baggage. She wondered if his judgment was perhaps clouded by other factors. And as he held the door for her, leading out to the main waiting room, Mayor Johns wondered if she was going along with him because her judgment was clouded as well. 10. It was lunchtime, but neither of them was powerfully hungry. Johns nibbled on a corn bar while she walked, priding herself on eating on the climb like a porter. They continued to pass these tradesmen, and Johns's esteem of their profession grew and grew. She had a strange pang of guilt from heading down under such a light load, while these men and women trudged up carrying so much. And they moved so fast. She and Marnes pressed themselves against the rail as a downward porter apologetically stomped past. His shadow, a girl of 15 or 16, was right behind him, loaded down with what looked to be sacks of garbage for the recycling center. Johns watched the young girl spiral out of sight, her sinewy and smooth legs hanging miles out of her shorts, and suddenly felt very old and very tired. The two of them fell into a rhythmic pace, the reach of each foot hovering over the next tread, a sort of collapsing of the bones, a resignation to gravity, falling to that foot, sliding the hand, extending the walking stick forward, repeat. Doubt crept into John's around the 30th floor. What had seemed a fine adventure at sunrise now seemed a mighty undertaking. Each step was performed reluctantly, with the knowledge of how grueling it would be to win that elevation back. They passed the upper water treatment plant on 32, and Johns realized she was seeing portions of the silo that were practically new to her. It had been a lifetime ago that she'd been this deep, a shameful thing to admit. And in that time, changes had been made. Construction and repairs were ongoing. Walls were a different color than she remembered. But then it was hard to trust one's memory. The traffic on the stairs lightened as they neared the IT floors. Here were the most sparsely populated levels of the silo, where fewer than 24 men and women, but mostly men, operated within their own little kingdom. The silo servers took up almost an entire floor, the machines slowly reloading with recent history, having been wiped completely during the uprising. Access to them was now severely restricted, and as Johns passed the landing on the 33rd, she swore she could hear the mighty thrumming of all the electricity they consumed. Whatever the silo had been, or had been originally designed for, she knew without asking or being told that these strange machines were some organ of primacy. Their power draw was a constant source of contention during budget meetings. But the necessity of the cleaning, the fear of even talking about the outside, and all the dangerous taboos that went with it, gave IT incredible leeway. They housed the labs that made the suits, each one tailored to the person waiting in the holding cell, and this alone set them apart from all else. No, Johns told herself. It wasn't simply the taboo of the cleaning, the fear of the outside. It was the hope. There was this unspoken, deadly hope in every member of the silo, a ridiculous, fantastical hope that maybe not for them, but perhaps for their children or their children's children, life on the outside would be possible once again, and that it would be the work of IT and the bulky suits that emerged from their labs that would make it all possible. Johns felt a shiver even to think it. Living outside. The childhood conditioning was that strong. Maybe God would hear her thoughts and rat her out. She imagined herself in a cleaning suit, a far too common thought, placing herself into the flexible coffin to which she had condemned so many. On the 34th, she slipped off onto the landing. Marnes joined her, his canteen in hand. Johns realized she'd been drinking out of his all day, while hers had stayed strapped to her back. There was something childlike and romantic about this, but also something practical. It was more difficult to reach one's own water than it was to grab that of the other from their pack.
You need a break?
He passed the canteen, which had two swallows left in it. Johns took one of them.
This is our next stop, she said.
Marnes looked up at the faded number stenciled over the doorway. He had to know what floor they were on, but it was as if he needed to double-check. Johns returned his canteen.
In the past, I've always wired them to get the okay on my nominations. It was something Mayor Humphreys did before me, and Mayor Jeffers before him.
She shrugged.
Way of the world.
I didn't know they had to approve.
He took the last swallow and patted Johns on the back, twirled his finger for her to turn around.
Well, they've never rejected any of my nominations.
Johns felt her canteen tugged out of her pouch, Marnes's canteen shoved in its place. Her pack felt a smidgen lighter. She realized Marnes wanted to carry her water and share it until it too was empty.
I think the unwritten rule is there just so we'll carefully consider every judge and lawman, knowing there's some informal oversight.
So this time you're doing it in person.
She turned back around to face her deputy.
I figured we were passing this way.
She paused while a young couple hurried up the stairs behind Marnes, holding hands and taking the treads two at a time.
And that it might feel even more conspicuous not to stop and check in.
Check in, Marnes said.
Johns half expected him to spit over the railing. The tone seemed to require such punctuation. She suddenly felt another of her weaknesses exposed.
Think of it as a goodwill mission, she said,
turning toward the door.
I'm going to think of it as a fact-finding raid, Marnes muttered, following her.
Johns could tell that, unlike at the nursery, they would not be buzzed through and sent back into the mysterious depths of IT. While they waited to be seen, she watched as even a member of the staff, identifiable from their silver overalls, was patted down and searched just to leave the wing and exit toward the stairs. A man with a wand, a member of IT's own internal security detail, seemed to have the job of checking everyone who passed through the metal gates. The receptionist on the outside of the gates was deferent enough, however, and seemed pleased to have the mayor for a visit. She expressed her condolences for the recent cleaning, an odd thing to say, but something Johns wished she heard more often. They were shown to a small conference room attached to the main foyer, a place, she supposed, for meeting with various departments without putting them through the hassle of passing through security.
Look at all this space, Marnes whispered once they were alone in the room together. Did you see the size of that entrance hall?
Johns nodded. She looked around the ceiling and walls for some peephole, something to confirm the creepy sensation that she was being watched. She set her bag and walking stick down and collapsed wearily into one of the plush chairs. When it moved, she realized the thing was on wheels, nicely oiled wheels.
Always wanted to check this place out, Marnes said.
He peered through the glass window that looked back into the wide foyer.
Every time I've passed this place, and it's only been a dozen times or so, I've been curious to see what's inside.
Johns nearly asked him to stop talking, but worried that it would hurt his feelings.
Boy, he's coming in a hurry. Must be because of you.
Johns turned and looked out the window to see Bernard Holland heading their way. He disappeared from view as he approached the door, the handle flicked down, and the small man whose job it was to keep IT running smoothly strode into the room.
Mayor?
Bernard was all teeth, the front ones crooked. He had a wispy mustache that hung down in a weak attempt to hide this flaw. Short, portly, and with a pair of glasses perched on his small nose, he looked every bit the technical expert. Above all, to Johns at least, he looked smart. He reached for Johns's hand as she rose from the chair, the blasted thing nearly scooting out from underneath her as she pressed down on the armrests.
Careful,
Bernard said, grabbing her elbow to steady her.
Deputy?
He nodded toward Marnes, while Johns regained her balance.
It's an honor to have you down. I know you don't take these trips often. Thanks for seeing us on short notice, Johns said. Of course. Please make yourselves comfortable.
He swept his hand over the lacquered conference table. It was nicer than the one in the mayor's office, though Johns assuaged herself by assuming it was shiny from being less frequently employed. She sat in the chair warily, then reached into her bag and produced the set of files.
Straight to business as always, Bernard said,
sitting beside her. He pushed his small round spectacles up his nose and glided forward on the chair until his plump belly met the desk.
Always appreciated that about you. We are, as you can imagine, with yesterday's unfortunate events, as busy as ever. Lots of data to go through.
How's that going?
Johns asked, while she arranged the material in front of her.
Some positives and negatives, as always. Readouts from some of the seal sensors showed improvement. Atmospheric levels of 8 of the known toxins have declined, though not by much. 2 have risen. Most have remained unchanged.
He waved his hand.
It's a lot of boring technical stuff, but it'll all be in my report. I should have it ported up before you get back to your office.
That'll be fine, John said.
She wanted to say something else, to acknowledge his department's hard work, to let him know that another cleaning had been successful. God knew why. But it was Holston out there, the closest thing she'd ever had to a shadow, the only man she'd ever seen running for her office when she was dead and feeding the roots of the fruit trees. It was too soon to mention it, much less applaud it.
I normally wire this sort of thing to you, she said, but since we were passing by, and you won't be out for the next committee meeting for, what, another 3 months?
The years go fast, Bernard said.
I just figured we could informally agree to this now, so I could offer our best candidate the job.
She glanced up at Marnes.
Once she accepts, we can finish the paperwork on our way back up, if you don't mind.
She slid the folder toward Bernard, and was surprised when he produced one of his own, rather than accept hers.
Well, let's go over this, Bernard said.
He opened his folder, licked his thumb, and flipped through a few pieces of high-quality paper.
We were wired about your visit, but your list of candidates didn't hit my desk until this morning. Otherwise, I would have tried to save you the trip down and back up.
He pulled out a piece of paper devoid of creases. It didn't even look bleached. Johns wondered where IT got such things while her office was held together with cornflour paste.
I'm thinking of the 3 names listed here, but Billings is our man.
We may consider him next,
Deputy Marnes started to say.
I think we should consider him now.
He slid the paper toward Johns. It was an acceptance contract. There were signatures at the bottom. One line was left blank, the mayor's name neatly printed underneath. She had to catch her breath.
You've already contacted Peter Billings about this? He accepted. The judge's robe was going to be a little stifling for him, being so young and full of energy. I thought he was a fine choice for that role, but I think he's an even better one now for the job of sheriff.
Johns remembered Peter's judicial nomination process. It had been one of the times she'd gone along with Bernard's suggestion, seeing it as a trade for a future pick of her own. She studied the signature, Peter's hand familiar from his various notes sent up on behalf of Judge Wilson, under whom he currently shadowed. She imagined one of the porters who had flown past them on the steps that day, apologizing as they went, rushing this very piece of paper down.
I'm afraid Peter is currently 3rd on our list,
Mayor Johns finally said. Her voice suddenly felt tired. It sounded frail and weak in the cavernous and wasteful space of that underused and outsized conference room. She looked up at Marnes, who was glaring at the contract, his jaw clenching and unclenching.
Well, I think we both know Murphy's name is on this list for flattery. He's too old for the job.
Younger than me,
Marnes interrupted.
I hold up just fine.
Bernard tilted his head.
Yes, well, your first choice simply won't do, I'm afraid. And why is that?
Johns asked.
I'm not sure how thorough your background check has been, but we've had enough problems with this candidate that I recognized her name, even though she's from maintenance.
Bernard said this last word like it was full of nails and might gut him to spit it out.
What kind of problems?
Marnes demanded. Johns shot the deputy a look of warning.
Nothing we would have wanted to report, mind you.
Bernard turned to Marnes. There was venom in the small man's eyes, a raw hatred for the deputy, or perhaps for the star in his chest.
Nothing worth involving the law, but there have been some creative requisitions from her office, items rerouted from our use, improper claims of priority and the like.
Bernard took a deep breath and folded his hands together on top of the folder in front of him.
I wouldn't go as far as calling it stealing, per se, but we have filed complaints with Deegan Knox as head of mechanical to inform him of these irregularities.
That's it?
Marnes growled.
Requisitions?
Bernard frowned. He spread his hands on the folder.
That's it? Have you been listening? The woman has practically stolen goods.
has had items rerouted from my department. It's not clear if these are even for silo use. They could be for personal gain. God knows the woman uses more than her allowance of electricity. Maybe she trades for chits.
Is this a formal accusation?
Marnes asked. He made a show of pulling his pad from his pocket and clicking his mechanical pen.
No. As I said, we would not want to trouble your office. But as you can see, this is not the sort of person to enter a career in high law. It's what I expect of a mechanic, to be honest, which is where I'm afraid this candidate should stay.
He patted the folder as if putting the issue to rest.
That's your suggestion, Mayor Johns said.
Why, yes, and I think since we have such a fine candidate ready and willing to serve and already living in the uptop,
I'll take your suggestion into account.
Johns took the crisp contract from the table and deliberately folded it in half, pinching the crease with her fingernails as she slid them down its length. She stuck the piece of paper in one of her folders while Bernard watched, horrified.
And since you have no formal complaints about our first candidate, I will take this as tacit approval to speak with her about the job.
Johns stood and grabbed her bag. She slid the folders into the outside pouch and secured the flap, then grabbed her walking stick from where it leaned against the conference table.
Thank you for seeing us. Yes, but...
Bernard scooted away from the table and hurried after her as Johns made for the door. Marnes got up and followed, smiling.
What should I tell Peter? He's of the assumption that he starts any time.
You should never have told him anything, Johns said.
She stopped in the foyer and glared at Bernard.
I gave you my list in confidence. You betrayed that. Now I appreciate all you do for the silo. You and I have a long and peaceable history working together, overseeing what might be the most prosperous age our people have known.
Which is why, Bernard began.
Which is why I'm forgiving this trespass, Mayor Johns said. This is my job. My people. They elected me to make these kinds of decisions. So my deputy and I will be on our way. We will give our top choice a fair interview, and I will be sure to stop by on my way up in case there is anything to sign.
Bernard spread his hands in defeat.
Very well, he said. I apologize. I only hope to expedite the process. Now, please, rest a little. You are our guests. Let me get you some food. Maybe some fruit?
We'll be on our way, Johns said.
Fine, he nodded. But at least some water. Top up your canteens.
Johns remembered one of them was already empty, and they had a few more flights to go.
That would be a kind gesture, she said.
She signaled to Marnes, who turned, so she could grab his canteen from his pack. And she turned her back so he could grab hers as well. Bernard waved to one of his workers to come fetch them and fill them up. But the entire time he kept his eyes on this curious and intimate exchange. 11. They were almost down to the 50s before Johns could think straight. She imagined she could feel the weight of Peter Billings's contract in her pack. Marnes muttered his own complaints from a few steps behind, bitching about Bernard and trying to keep up, and Johns realized she was fixated now. The weariness in her thighs and calves had become compounded by the growing sense that this trip was more than a mistake. It was probably futile. A father who warns her that his daughter won't accept. Pressure from IT to choose another. Now each step of their descent was taken with dread. Dread, and yet a new certainty that Juliet was the person for the job. They would have to convince this woman from mechanical to take the post, if only to show Bernard, if only to keep this arduous journey from becoming a total waste. Johns was old, had been mayor a long time, partly because she got things done, partly because she prevented worse things from happening, but mostly because she rarely made a ruckus. She felt like it was about time, now while she was old enough for the consequences not to matter. She glanced back at Marnes and knew the same went for him. Their time was almost up. The best, the most important thing they could do for the silo was to make sure their legacy endured. No uprisings, no abuses of power. It was why she had run unopposed the last few elections, but now she could sense that she was gliding to the finish while stronger and younger runners were preparing to overtake her. How many judges had she signed off on at Bernard's request? And now the sheriff, too? How long before Bernard was mayor? Or worse, a puppet master with strings interwoven throughout the silo?
Take it easy,
Marnes huffed. Johns realized she was going too fast. She slowed her pace.
That bastard's got you riled up, he said.
And you better be as well, she hissed back at him.
You're passing the gardens.
Johns checked the landing number and saw that he was right. If she'd been paying attention, she would have noticed the smell. When the doors on the next landing flew open, a porter bearing sacks of fruit on each shoulder strode out, the scent of lush and wet vegetation accompanying him and overpowering her. It was past dinner time, and the smell was intoxicating. The porter, even though overburdened, saw that they were leaving the stairwell for the landing and held the door open with a planted foot as his arms bulged around the weight of the large sacks.
Mayor,
he said, bowing his head and then nodding to Marnes as well. Johns thanked him. Most of the porters looked familiar to her. She'd seen them over and over as they delivered throughout the silo. But they never stayed in one place long enough for her to catch and remember a name, a normally keen skill of hers. She wondered, as she and Marnes entered the hydroponic farms, if the porters made it home every night to be with their families. Or did they even have families? Were they like the priests? She was too old and too curious not to know these things. But then, maybe it took a day on the stairwell to appreciate their job, to notice them fully. The porters were like the air she breathed, always there, always serving, so necessary as to be ubiquitous and taken for granted. But now the weariness of the descent had opened her senses completely to them. It was like a sudden drop in the oxygen, triggering her appreciation.
Smell those oranges,
Marnes said, snapping Johns out of her thoughts. He sniffed the air as they passed through the low garden gates. A staff member in green overalls waved them through.
Bags here, Mayor,
he said, gesturing to a wall of cubbies sporadically filled with shoulder bags and bundles. Johns complied, leaving her kit in one of the cubbies. Marnes pushed hers to the back and added his to the same one. Whether it was to save space or merely his habitual protectiveness, Johns found the act as sweet as the air inside the gardens.
We have reservations for the evening,
Johns told the worker. He nodded.
One flight down for the rooms. I believe they're still getting yours ready. Are you here just for a visit or to eat?
A little of both.
The young man smiled. Well, by the time you've had a bite, your room should be available.
Rooms, Johns thought.
She thanked the young man and followed Marnes into the garden network.
How long since you were here?
She asked the deputy.
Well, a while back. 4 years or so?
That's right. Johns laughed. How could I forget? The heist of the century.
I'm glad you think it's funny,
Marnes said. At the end of the hallway, the twisting spiral of the hydroponic gardens diverted off both ways. This main tunnel snaked through two levels of the silo, curving maze-like all the way to the edges of the distant concrete walls. The constant sound of water dripping from the pipes was oddly soothing, the splatters echoing off the low ceiling. The tunnel was open on either side, revealing the bushy green of plants, vegetables, and small trees growing amid the lattice of white plastic pipes, twine strung everywhere to give the creeping vines and stems something to hold on to. Men and women with their young shadows, all in green overalls, tended to the plants. Sacks hung around their necks, bulged with the day's harvest, and the cutters in their hands clacked like little claws that were a biological part of them. The pruning was mesmerizingly adroit and effortless, the sort of ability that came only from day after week after year of practice and repetition.
Weren't you the first one to suggest the thievery was an inside job?
Johns asked, still laughing to herself. She and Marnes followed the signs pointing toward the tasting and dining halls.
Are we really going to talk about this?
I don't know why it's embarrassing. You've got to laugh about it.
With time.
He stopped and gazed through the mesh fencing at a stand of tomatoes. The powerful odor of their ripeness made Johns' stomach grumble.
We were really hyped up to make a bust at the time,
Marnes said quietly.
Holston was a mess during all of this. He was wiring me every night for an update. I've never seen him want to take someone down so bad. Like he really needed it, you know?
He wrapped his fingers in the protective grate and stared past the vegetables, as if into the years gone by.
Looking back, it's almost like he knew something was up with Allison, like he saw the madness coming.
Marnes turned to Johns.
Do you remember what it was like before she cleaned? It had been so long. Everyone was on edge.
Johns had long since stopped smiling. She stood close to Marnes. He turned back to the plants, watched a worker snip off a red ripe tomato and place it in her basket.
I think Holston wanted to let the air out of the silo, you know. I think he wanted to come down and investigate the thefts himself. Kept wiring me every day for reports, like a life depended on it.
I'm sorry to bring it up,
John said, resting a hand on his shoulder. Marnes turned and looked at the back of her hand. His bottom lip was visible below his mustache. John's could picture him kissing her hand. She pulled it away.
It's fine, he said. Without all that baggage, I guess it is pretty funny.
He turned and continued down the hallway.
Did they ever figure out how it got in here?
Up the stairwell, Marnes said. Had to be. Though I heard one person suggest that a child could have stolen one to keep as a pet and then released it up here.
Johns laughed. She couldn't help herself.
One rabbit, she said, confounding the greatest lawman of our time and making off with a year's salary of greens.
Marnes shook his head and chuckled a little.
Not the greatest, he said. That was never me.
He peered down the hallway and cleared his throat, and Johns knew perfectly well who he was thinking of. After a large and satisfying dinner, they retired a level down to the guest rooms. Johns had a suspicion that extra pains had been taken to accommodate them. Every room was packed, many of them double and triple booked. And since the cleaning had been scheduled well before this last-minute interview adventure of theirs, she suspected rooms had been bumped around to make space. The fact that they'd been given separate rooms, the mayor's with two beds, made it worse. It wasn't just the waste, it was the arrangement. Johns was hoping to be more inconvenienced. And Marnes must have felt the same way, since it was still hours before bedtime, and they were both buzzing from a fine meal and strong wine. He asked her to his small room so they could chat while the garden settled down. His room was tastefully cozy, with only a single twin bed, but nicely appointed. The upper gardens were one of just a dozen large private enterprises. All the expenses for their stay would be covered by her office's travel budget, and that money, as well as the fares of the other travelers, helped the establishment afford finer things, like nice sheets from the looms and a mattress that didn't squeak. Johns sat on the foot of the bed. Marnes took off his holster, placed it on the dresser, and plopped onto a changing bench just a few feet away. While she kicked off her boots and rubbed her sore feet, he went on and on about the food, the waste of separate rooms, brushing his mustache down with his hand as he spoke. Johns worked her thumbs into the soreness in her heels.
I feel like I'm going to need a week of rest at the bottom before we start the climb up, she said during a pause.
It's not all that bad, Marnes told her. You watch. You'll be sore in the morning, but once you start moving, you'll find that you're stronger than you were today. And it's the same on the way up. You just lean into each step, and before you know it, you're home.
I hope you're right.
Besides, we'll do it in 4 days instead of two. Just think of it as an adventure.
Trust me, Johns said. I already am.
They sat quietly for a while, Johns resting back on the pillows, Marnes staring off into space. She was surprised to find how calming and natural it was, just being in a room, alone, with him. The talk wasn't necessary. They could just be. No badge, no office, two people.
You don't take a priest, do you?
Marnes finally asked.
No,
she shook her head.
Do you?
I haven't, but I've been thinking about it.
Holston?
Partly.
He leaned forward and rubbed his hands down his thighs, like he was squeezing the soreness out of them.
I'd like to hear where they think his soul has gone.
It's still with us, John said. That's what they'd say anyway.
What do you believe?
Me?
She pushed herself up from the pillows and rested on one elbow, watching him watch her.
I don't know, really. I keep too busy to think about it.
Do you think Donald's soul is still here with us?
John's felt a shiver. She couldn't remember the last time someone had uttered his name.
He's been gone more years than he was ever my husband, she said. I've been married more to his ghost than to him.
That don't seem like the right thing to say.
Johns looked down at the bed, the world a little blurry.
I don't think he'd mind. And yes, he's still with me. He motivates me every day to be a good person. I feel him watching me all the time.
Me too, Marnes said.
Johns looked up and saw that he was staring at her.
Do you think he'd want you to be happy? In all things, I mean.
He stopped rubbing his legs and sat there, hands on his knees, until he had to look away.
You were his best friend,
Johns said.
What do you think he'd want?
He rubbed his face, glanced toward the closed door as a laughing child thundered down the hallway.
I reckon he only ever wanted you to be happy. That's why he was the man for you.
Johns wiped her eyes while he wasn't looking and peered curiously down at her wet fingers.
It's getting late, she said.
She slid to the edge of the small bed and reached down for her boots. Her bag and stick were waiting for her by the door.
And I think you're right. I think I'll be a little sore in the morning, but I think I'll feel stronger eventually.
12. On the second and final day of their descent into the down deep, the novel gradually became the habitual. The clank and thrum of the great spiral staircase found a rhythm. Johns was able to lose herself in her thoughts, daydreaming so serenely that she would glance up at the floor number 72, 84, and wonder where a dozen landings went. The kink in her left knee was even soothed away, whether by the numbness of fatigue or an actual return to health, she didn't know. She took to using the walking stick less, finding it only held up her pace as it often slipped between the treads and got caught there. With it tucked under her arm, it felt more useful, like another bone in her skeleton holding her together. When they passed the 90th floor, with the stench of fertilizer and the pigs and other animals that produced this useful waste, Johns pressed on, skipping the tour and lunch she'd planned, thinking only briefly of the small rabbit that somehow had escaped from another farm, made it 20 floors up without being spotted, and ate its fill for 3 weeks while it confounded half a silo. Technically, they were already in the down deep when they reached 97, the bottom third. But even though the silo was mathematically divided into three sections of 48 floors each, her brain didn't work that way. Floor 100 was a better demarcation. It was a milestone. She counted the floors down until they reached the first landing with three digits and stopped for a break. Marnes was breathing deeply, she noticed, but she felt great, alive and renewed in the way she had hoped the trip would make her feel. The futility, dread, and exhaustion from the day before were gone. All that remained was a small twinge of fear that these dour feelings could return, that this exuberant elation was a temporary high, that if she stopped, if she thought on it too long, it would spiral away and leave her dark and moody once more. They split a small loaf of bread between them, sitting on the metal grating of the wide landing with their elbows propped up on the railings, their feet swinging over empty space like two kids cutting glass. Level 100 teemed with people coming and going. The entire floor was a bazaar, a place for exchanging goods, for cashing in work chits for whatever was needed or merely coveted. Workers with their trailing shadows came and went, families yelled for one another among the dizzying crowds, merchants barked their best deals. The doors remained propped open for the traffic, letting the smells and sounds drift out onto the double-wide landing, the grating shivering with excitement. Johns reveled in the anonymity of the passing crowd. She bit into her half of the loaf, savoring the fresh yeastiness of bread baked that morning, and felt like just another person, a younger person. Marnes cut her a piece of cheese and a slice of apple and sandwiched them together. His hand touched hers as he passed it to her. Even the breadcrumbs in his mustache were part of the moment's perfection.
We're way ahead of schedule, Marnes said before taking a bite of fruit.
It was just a pleasant observation, a pat on their elderly backs.
I figure we'll hit 140 by dinner.
Right now I'm not even dreading the climb out,
Johns said. She finished the cheese and apple and chewed contentedly. Everything tasted better while climbing, she decided. We're in pleasant company. We're amid the music leaking out of the bazaar, some beggar strumming his uke over the noise of the crowd.
Why don't we come down here more often?
She asked. Marnes grunted.
Because it's 100 flights down? Besides, we've got the view, the lounge, the bar at Kipper's. How many of these people come up to any of that more than once every few years?
Johns chewed on that and on her last bite of bread.
Do you think it's natural, not wandering too far from where we live?
Don't follow,
Marnes said around a bite of food.
Pretend, just as a hypothetical, mind you, that people lived in those ancient above-ground silos poking up over the hillside. You don't think they would move around so little, do you? Like stay in the same silo, never wander over here or up and down 100 flights of stairs?
I don't think on those things, Marnes said.
Johns took it as a hint that she shouldn't either. It was impossible sometimes to know what could and couldn't be said about the outside. Those were discussions for spouses, and maybe the walk and the day together yesterday had gotten to her. Or maybe she was as susceptible to the post-cleaning high as anyone else. The sense that some rules could be relaxed, a few temptations courted, the release of pressure in the silo giving excuse for a month of jubilant wiggling in one's own skin.
Should we get going?
Johns asked as Marnes finished his bread. He nodded, and they stood and collected their things. A woman walking by turned and stared, a flash of recognition on her face, gone as she hurried to catch up with her children. It was like another world down here, Johns thought to herself. She had gone too long without a visit, and even as she promised herself not to let that happen again, some part of her knew, like a rusting machine that could feel its age, that this journey would be her last. Floors drifted in and out of sight. The lower gardens, the larger farm in the 130s, the pungent water treatment plant below that. Johns found herself lost in thought, remembering her conversation with Marnes the night before. The idea of Donald living with her more in memory than reality when she came to the gate at 140. She hadn't even noticed the change in the traffic, the preponderance of blue denim overalls, the porters with more satchels of parts and tools than clothes, food, or personal deliveries. But the crowd at the gate showed her that she'd arrived at the upper levels of mechanical. Gathered at the entrance were workers in loose blue overalls, spotted with age-old stains. Johns could nearly peg their professions by the tools they carried. It was late in the day, and she assumed most were returning home from repairs made throughout the silo. The thought of climbing so many flights of stairs and then having to work boggled her mind. And then she remembered she was about to do that very thing. Rather than abuse her station or Marnes's power, they waited in line while the workers checked through the gate. As these tired men and women signed back in and logged their travel and hours, Johns thought of the time she had wasted ruminating about her own life during the long descent, time she should have spent polishing her appeal to this Juliet. Rare nerves twisted her gut as the line shuffled forward. The worker ahead of them showed his ID, a card colored blue for mechanical. He scratched his information on a dusty slate. When it was their turn, they pushed through the outer gate and showed their golden IDs. The station guard raised his eyebrows, then seemed to recognize the mayor.
Your Honor, he said, and Johns didn't correct him. Weren't expecting you this shift.
He waved their IDs away and reached for a nub of chalk.
Let me.
Johns watched as he spun the board around and wrote their names in neat print, the side of his palm collecting dust from the old film of chalk below. For Marnes, he simply wrote, Sheriff, and again, Johns didn't correct him.
I know she wasn't expecting us until later, Johns said, but I wonder if we could meet with Juliet Nichols now.
The station guard turned and looked behind him at the digital clock that recorded the proper time.
She won't be off the generator for another hour, maybe two, knowing her. He could hit the mess hall and wait.
Johns looked at Marnes, who shrugged.
Not entirely hungry yet, he said.
What about seeing her at work? It would be nice to see what she does. We'd try our best to stay out of the way.
The guard lifted his shoulders.
You're the mayor. I can't say no.
He jabbed the nub of chalk down the hall, the people lined up outside the gate shifting impatiently as they waited.
See Knox. He'll get someone to run you down.
The head of mechanical was a man hard to miss. Knox amply filled the largest set of overalls Johns had ever seen. She wondered if the extra denim cost him more chits, and how a man managed to keep such a belly full. A thick beard added to his scope. If he smiled or frowned at their approach, it was impossible to know. He was as unmoved as a wall of concrete. Johns explained what they were after. Marnes said hello, and she realized they must have met the last time he was down. Knox listened, nodded, and then bellowed in a voice so gruff the words were indistinguishable from one another. But they meant something to someone, as a young boy materialized from behind him, a waif of a kid with unusually bright orange hair.
Get him off and down to Jules,
Knox growled, the space between the words as slender as the gap in his beard where a mouth should have been. The young boy, young even for a shadow, waved his hand and darted away. Marnes thanked Knox, who didn't budge, and they followed after the boy. The corridors and mechanical John saw were even tighter than elsewhere in the silo. They squeezed through the end-of-shift traffic, the concrete blocks on either side primed but not painted, and rough where they brushed against her shoulder. Overhead, parallel and twisting runs of pipe and wire conduit hung exposed. Johns felt the urge to duck, despite the half-foot of clearance. She noticed many of the taller workers walking with a stoop. The lights overhead were dim and spaced well apart, making the sensation of tunneling deeper.